This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, it's Pia, and every Wednesday, we're bringing you a bonus podcast, one handpicked story from the week's round of the Sunday magazine that we think is definitely worth hearing or hearing again. Of course, you can hear all of our stories on the full podcast that we put out on Sunday and on the CBC Listen app. All right, here's this week's highlight. Guarani's feats in journalism have been many over the past three decades. You might have seen her anchor her own namesake show on CNN International or watched her in the field reporting amid countless conflicts in the Middle East and beyond, or interviewing world leaders, people including Tony Blair and Shimon Peres, the Dalai Lama. But alongside her career, Hala's been on a quest that is common to many people, trying to understand her identity and what it means to belong as a person whose life and work span the globe. Hala delves into that journey in a new memoir. It is called But You Don't Look Arab. Hala Guarani, hi.
Hi, Pia.
You have such a giant life story that is shaped by various cultures and countries. So just to kind of lay it out for our listeners, you are a kid of Syrian and French parents who moved to the U.S. where you were born. And then you moved to France with your mom after your folks got divorced. And then you spent much of your upbringing there. So given the number of places and backgrounds and influences, how did that big context sort of shape your understanding of who you were growing up? Because it's hard being a kid growing up at the best of times.
It really is. And it wasn't just that my parents were Syrian, that I was raised in France, born in the U.S., and then lived for many years in London. It was also that I came from, even within my own family, from generations of displacement. I talk in the book about how when the Ottoman Empire finally completely collapsed, the Arab members of my family who were living in Istanbul had to go back to their ancestral home in Aleppo. And generation after generation, this is kind of a universal story, really. It's not just an Arab and a Middle Eastern story. People have to be on the move all the time. It's a great privilege, people don't realize, in Western countries, to have ancestors over many generations in the country where you live. I didn't have, you know, sort of like church registry weddings that I could consult when I did my research. Everything is scattered all around the world because people look for economic opportunity. They flee wars and revolutions and natural disasters. And here I am, the product of all of that.
So this kind of brings us to the title of your book, which is But You Don't Look Arab. So I have to say, when I moved to the Middle East in 2006, you know, I knew there would be a diversity of people and people would look different. But every time I met a bright blue-eyed blonde Egyptian or a redheaded Palestinian or a very dark Israeli, it always reminded me that there was so much diversity in a part of the world that I think a lot of people think people look all the same. And so can you just describe for people who may never have laid eyes on you what you look like and how often you sort of heard that line that your title of the book is from, which is, but you don't look Arab, and what how that sort of landed for you?
So for people who don't know what I look like, I look a lot like Claudia Schiffer. No, I'm just
You do, a little bit. There's a resemblance.
With radio, I can just say that. No, I think the reason I decided to go with that title is because, look, I want to confront stereotypes. I mean, fundamentally, it's what we kids of immigrant parents try to do our entire lives. You know, oh, you're Arab? Oh, you're Muslim? Oh, you must be fasting or you must pray five times a day. Why don't you wear a hijab? Why don't you this? Why don't you that? As if you are, as the kid of an immigrant, the representative, the ambassador, and the spokesperson for a billion people. And that can be exhausting. And I know that kids and what so-called third culture kids can be exhausted by that, because as a child, you want nothing more than to fit in. And you don't fit in when your name is Hala. And my dad's name was Basha. So my name in France when I grew up was Hala Basha. people don't pronounce the H, so I became Allah. Every joke in the book about Allah, you know, was hurled at me as a kid, and I just got tired of it. So that title just illustrates the fact that we are diverse. Every population, subpopulation, subculture is diverse. And here I am, a blonde, blue-eyed Arab with Syrian parents, and we exist. You know, I think that's why I went for it.
There's a kid listening to us. More adults than kids, let's be fair, that listen to our program. But there is a kid listening to us who's saying to themselves, well, I get that all the time. I get, you don't look, you know, fill in the blank here.
Yeah.
What do you say to them?
I'm not going to lie. It's not easy. When you're that age, you want to be like everyone else and you want to look like everyone else. When I grew up in France, you know, I talk about in the book about how I didn't have like that genetic French skinniness and I didn't look like those, you know, French girls with named after fruit like Clementine and prune and stuff. I desired nothing more than to be like them. And but say to that kid, of course, the advice we would give any child is embrace your difference. It's great to not be like everyone else. But this is something that you only appreciate in adulthood. And I think there is a wound that kind of there's a bit of an injury, kind of a psychological injury as a child that heals in adulthood and gives you strength. But in childhood, it's sometimes a little bit difficult to navigate. I think the one thing I would tell parents rather than the child is if you come from a different culture, and there are so many cases like this in Canada, it would be good not to move the kid around too much. I always change schools every 2 or 3 years, and that wasn't ideal. So I think if the kid is given a really firm foundation, that would certainly help a lot.
Okay, so let's talk about that sort of injury, because injuries, as you say, heal, and they often help sort of guide us in what we want to do in life. We might not realize it, but they kind of do. So those questions of identity that were swirling around for you and your family history, how did they really inform your choice to pursue journalism?
I think they were a huge part in it because I've always loved the idea of researching my family background. It's a very rich and unusual and exotic story. You know, all through the Ottoman Empire and then via Aleppo, Baghdad, Bulgaria, Abkhazia, you name it. But also this moving around a lot, this speaking several languages. And in Middle Eastern households, this is also something that really is, I think, important to underline when it came to my career choice. People talk about the news all the time. Because the Middle East was in the news and still is in the news, you would hear talk of current events. You would know who the presidents of countries were. You would have a basic understanding of geography, even as a child. So I think that as an adult, then, when I was choosing a career, it made a lot of sense to go into that. So the two things, loving the you know, research, documentation, and also being interested in current affairs, those two things came together. And so it became an obvious career choice.
Hmm. Okay. So then you go to this prestigious Paris university and you got to get a job, right? You come out of school, you're trying to get a job. And again, who you are and your background and your identity plays into your luck, good luck, bad luck. Let's talk about when you start applying for jobs. You weren't having much luck. So what do you chalk that up to?
Well, I mean, just anecdotally, I didn't have a photo on my resume. I mentioned that I spoke Arabic. My name was very Arab sounding, and I wasn't getting any callbacks. And some of my friends who'd graduated at the same time as me from Sciences Po in Paris were getting a lot more, you know, were getting more interviews. And one of my friends said to me, you know, I would just remove the fact that you speak Arabic because they're going to think that, you know, you're North African Arab. You know, it's sad, right? But I did it because I was so desperate to work in journalism that in a way you kind of whitewash yourself to fit in. And it worked. I got more interviews. But despite it all, I had to leave France because I just didn't feel like I hadn't done the right school. I didn't have the right profile. And so, you know, I joined Bloomberg and then a few years later, CNN, where I felt like there was more opportunity for me there.
Yeah. You didn't just, you know, do the photo. You took off that you spoke Arabic and you changed your name.
Yeah. I changed my name from my dad's name, Basha, to Gorani, my mom's name. And Gorani, and they're both Syrian, but Gorani just sounded more generically European.
Yeah.
yeah, and just sounded, in French, it became, instead of Ala Bacha, it became Ala Gorani. And then that sounds, I don't know, Balkan, Italian, something like that. And it was, I got fewer questions as well.
Yeah, I can't. I mean, these aren't historical sort of stories. I can't tell you the number of times people have asked me why I didn't change my name, that I should change my name, or that I should pronounce my name the way it's pronounced in Bengali, which is my parents' language, which is Chattopadhyay. And I always say, chances if I said Pia Chattopadhyay on the air, people wouldn't hear what I was reporting on, or would say, well, what is that? You know, so names are a funny thing in that way, that they people take them as an access point.
Yeah. But also you don't say, you know, you don't pronounce country names and city names in the way that natives pronounce them. I mean, you have to adapt to the name, your name, my name, to the language and to the culture. Otherwise, it just becomes, you put yourself out of reach in a different way by not somehow adapting the pronunciation to the local language.
Yeah, you know? And that's changing. I see younger journalists and other people, you know, really sticking to, but we grew up in a slightly different time, and so we adapted and all those things. But it is a strange balancing act, isn't it, Hala? Like, on the one hand, in your case, you know, people can misread you, perhaps even be skeptical of you. But on the other hand, you also have this privilege of passing as white.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I have, the privilege goes both ways. So I can also, when I'm in the Middle East, speak Arabic and integrate. And when I'm in a Western country, I look and sound completely Western. It's when that first kind of introduction is made, and the name is, and I introduce myself with my name, that the questions start. But otherwise, I do have the privilege. For instance, I can tell you, my brother looks very Middle Eastern. Let's just say he gets a lot more questions at the airport than I do. Clearly, I can blend in a lot more easily than someone who more obviously looks Middle Eastern or Arab. But again, I think it's, for in my job, it's great because I could go report on at a funeral in the West Bank and speak Arabic with people there. And then a few weeks later, go cover a Trump rally. And no one in either place will question my presence there because of the way I look. So that's a huge privilege as a journalist.
Yeah, you can code switch all the time, right?
All the time, yeah.
If you're just joining us on this Sunday morning, I'm Pia Chattopadhyay, and I'm speaking with Hala Gorani, the journalist, about identity and belonging and her career as an anchor and correspondent over the past three decades. She has a new memoir out. It's called But You Don't Look Arab. Okay, so Hala, once you sort of break through in journalism, then things really take off for you. You become an anchor for Bloomberg, as you mentioned, in London, then for CNN International. When did you first really say, like, look, I've got a big asset here. I can really, I have this knowledge, I have this understanding of Arab culture. I am of that heritage. When did you finally start to leverage your knowledge of Arab culture and language and the Middle East in your work?
I think after 9/11, really, when it became obvious that, and in the lead up to the Iraq war, but it wasn't that easy, you know? I mean, I was a woman in my 20s, and I wasn't being necessarily given those assignments. I mean, I was asked to anchor a design show for a year, you know. But then after the Iraq war really started in earnest and it became a very dangerous place to report from, if you were volunteering for those assignments, you were being sent. That's when I think it really started working in my favor, this notion that I could understand the culture, speak the language, and then really that's something you wanted to add to your resume at that point, not remove from your resume. Then there was the Israel-Hezbollah war, that I covered, and that was a really pivotal moment in my career because I felt like that was the one war that I covered from beginning to end and from the inside, from a culture I knew, the Levant, and a city that I knew pre-war, pre that war, obviously, because it was post to the Civil War. It was, I think it was around that time that I started really feeling like my background and my language skills were a huge plus.
That was 2006, and it was when I landed in the Middle East to be a correspondent over there. And I know I told you this before we started, but seeing you on television I could see a little bit of maybe what I aspired to or who I could be. So thank you for that. I really appreciate having seen you because I felt like I was seen.
Thank you.
And we were talking before we started about Christiane Amanpour, who you write about as well. Trailblazer for, I think, every female journalist, especially war correspondents and reporters out in the field. And you write, quote, "Her qualities are usually those lauded in men but scorned in women." What do you mean by that?
I hope she'll like that I'm saying this about her. She doesn't really ask, you know, she says, "I'm doing this." And this is something that I think when women are assertive in that way, they're labeled as difficult and as bitchy or as rude or as egomaniacs. And I think oftentimes, and we've heard this before, when men behave in similar ways, they're simply, you know, go-getters and assertive. And I always admired her for that. And she's still that way. I mean, she's of another generation. She's older than we are. But she's still, you know, out there doing incredible work. And that's what I meant when I wrote that. You know, she's just somebody who is extremely confident in a way that gets her the assignments and the respect, not just of viewers, but, you know, of management and the bosses. And I think that's one of the hardest things for women to do. And it is to say, I want this or I don't want that. That's also something I think that's very difficult for women to do, is to say, I know this assignment you're telling me I should be doing, I don't want to do it.
And so how did that change how you approached your career once you started thinking about, like, look, I want to be like Amanpour, at least in the approach and the confidence and all those things?
Mm-hmm. I think I learned early on that when you want something, you need to come to managers and bosses with a plan, with a budget. You can't just sit kind of back and expect people to come to you with the assignments. And that's something as well that somebody like Christiane, but many, many others, I mean, Clarissa Ward, who's a great friend, they are go-getters. They are people with plans. They have strategies to cover stories. They figure out ways to get access. This is early on what I tried to do in my career. I don't expect someone to come to me and offer me the perfect assignment. I have to come up with it myself. And I have to come up with the budget and the access and a security plan and everything else. So I think that's probably how observing people like Christiane and other amazing female correspondents like Lise Doucette, who's Canadian, by the way.
Yes, yes.
And others, and Lindsay Hilsum, and all of these fantastic women who are icons and who have been my inspiration for many years. When I look at how they do journalism, they do it proactively. There's no waiting for something to be offered to them or waiting for inspiration.
And one of the things when you start covering various stories in the Middle East is that it seems like a no-brainer. Like the fact that you know the culture, that you speak the language, that you're familiar with some of these places would just be such an asset. But you also talk about getting pushback.
Well, you do have, I mean, on some stories, on the Syria story, on the Israel-Gaza story, there you have such entrenched camps. You might get some attacks from one side or the other because on any given day you're doing a story about, you know, one topic versus another. So that sometimes happens. But by and large, I have to say, it has not been a difficult experience for me over the last several decades of working in the Middle East. If anything, I get a lot of, oh, we're so proud of you. Mm-hmm. By the way, I take that for granted, the we're so proud of you, because this is a region that in the grand arc of history is going through a very tough time right now. The last, I don't know, 100 years or so, or 70 years or so of the Middle East. So when you represent in the minds of people from that part of the world, achievement on some level, and you get the we're so proud of you, it just warms my heart. I just feel like I have all these aunties and uncles who are just like watching me and saying, oh, look, she's from where we come from. And she's done well. And she's represented us well. So that's always fabulous to hear.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm sure you hear that as well.
I do. I was smiling when you said that. And there's, you know, I have a million stories of going to drop off my dry cleaning and the guy that works there is South Asian and says, my 12-year-old kid, she saw you or she heard you. And like, it's all, It's amazing. It's the best gift.
Isn't it? Especially when you hear it, when you hear parents say that their kids are inspired by you, that is absolutely fabulous. Best feeling.
Let's talk about Syria, because as you say, it's been a difficult time in history for Syria. And the last 13 years this year, this month marks 13 years since the civil war started. And I'm wondering how you're reflecting on that more broadly when you look at Syria today and, you know, the hope of the so-called Arab Spring and the humanitarian crisis, the war that we see there now, as someone of Syrian heritage, as a journalist who has covered it. And how are you just thinking about it 13 years later?
Yeah, I think that it is the one story that still saddens me almost with the same intensity now as it did 13 years ago. Because I always describe Syria, I never lived there, I wasn't born there, but it was almost as if Syria was a member of my family. And as if that family member died, you know, or was very, very ill. So I don't go back to Syria now. I don't think it would be necessarily a good idea. But it's something that still absolutely makes me emotional and sad. And I don't know that I'll ever get over it. More than any other story, because when you're from somewhere, of course, you know the streets, you know the landmarks, the Mamluk era hammam, the Ottoman hotel, the citadel in Aleppo, the souk, the whatever, all these places that have been destroyed. It's like every time it was like being stabbed in the heart. It was horrible. And now I can kind of look back and smile at some of the memories, but it's still very, very painful.
You know, you started at the beginning of our conversation talking about your family's history of displacement. And of course, you have been reporting on conflicts, the war in Ukraine, the Israel-Hamas war. Those themes of displacement and statelessness come up time and time again. So I'm just wondering, as you're covering those stories and thinking about displacement and your own story, what are you thinking about the idea of displacement nowadays?
Well, now with globalization and so many kids straddling two or three cultures, it's becoming more and more common, I think, for children to be the children of globalization and displacement and migration. It's not necessarily a bad thing. I think that it's sometimes a little bit confusing when, for instance, in my case, I was moved around a lot. But I think ultimately it is a source of enrichment. And it depends entirely on how I think also the child is told, how that displacement is explained to them. I think I wrote this book in some ways to make peace with this notion that I am the product of these generations of displacement and migration and uprooting. And I came to a conclusion that, you know, I think my home is in the journey, in a sense, that I found my home in this constant movement that has just defined my life. Would I have preferred more stability? Maybe ultimately it would have made me maybe a less anxious, less kind of a little bit less on the move, but I would have not had as rich a life as I have led. So that's kind of where I think where I landed on that question.
And on the more philosophical question, Hala, of belonging, because you have written the book, it's out in the world, you've had a bit of time to reflect.
Yeah.
On the bigger philosophical meaning of belonging, how's that sitting with you?
It's a question that I'm still grappling with. Where do I belong? What culture do I belong in? I'm not a member of any tribe. You know, I write in the book that people who feel at home everywhere and nowhere belong to tribes of one. And it's lonely to be in a tribe of one. You know, I think I understand why people embrace religious communities or expat communities, because that's where you belong. But I've never really been able to find a home in any one group. And I don't think that will ever change, because if at 54, I'm still kind of feeling a little stateless in terms of what group I need to integrate or where I belong, I don't think that's going to change in the years that I have left. So I've come to the conclusion that I'm still just going to be roaming and observing and doing my job as a journalist and writing about other people and hoping that I can see myself reflected in the people I cover. I mean, I write in the book that every time I interview someone who looks out of place, I ask them all these questions because I want to find some of me in them. They don't realize it, but that's really what I'm doing.
There's so many people that are trying to find themselves and where they belong and maybe not coming up with the obvious answer, but there's so many people in the same situation. And I think your story will help them see themselves. So thank you for it.
Thank you so much. I hope it's at least one piece of the puzzle for somebody.
Thanks, Hala.
Thank you.
Hala Gurani is a longtime anchor and correspondent. She currently works for MSNBC and NBC News. Her memoir is called But You Don't Look Arab. You can find all the stories we bring you each week on the Sunday Magazine over on our website, cbc.ca/Sunday. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay. Thank you for lending us your ear, and we'll talk to you again on Sunday.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.